For the last 8 years, Democrats across this country have been accused of being unpatriotic because we dared to exercise a right that so many have died for, the right to redress our grievances with and against our own government. We have allowed political operatives to divide this country down party lines, not out of a love or desire for their own countrymen's mutual prosperity, but rather to win. We have seen some of the closest elections in history as a generally uninformed electorate has tried desperately to keep their heads above water, raise their children, and leave this world a better place than we arrived. All the while, we are turned against each other over issues that are designed to divide these once United States of America. It is unfathomable to me that we are raising our children in the United States where we are currently having a debate over whether or not we will trust science over theology, whether the warming of our earth is real, whether we should help those without health care, whether we should offer a helping hand to those who have the least among us, or even whether we will torture people. Where is our country gone? Is this what it means to be patriotic in the United States? My fellow Americans, we can do better. No, we must do better. And starting today, we will do better. No longer will the moderate voices of reason be silenced by the shrieks of the fringes. This is not the America our forefathers died to protect. But today, we strive to make it truly a more perfect union by standing up for ourselves, by holding our heads up high and proudly proclaiming that I am an American. To understand the road we must take, we must first understand why we are all here. This country was founded on an idea, the idea that we would free ourselves from tyranny and stand up for what is right, that man was born with the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that flag that is so often wrapped around those who wish to do this nation harm stands for something more than a backdrop. That flag has a story, and enshrined in that story is who we are as a nation. It is a story most Americans have never heard completely. So today I ask you to join me in our inaugural show as we restore the mantle of patriotism to its rightful owners. Not a red America, not a blue America, but we the people of the United States of America. This story, originally entitled Defense of Fort McHenry, says it all.
This is Jim Alger, and this is Common Sense.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
Why do the Republicans hate America?
Their only play right now in Congress is to hope the Democratic Party fails.
It's not even us in the U.S. It's us in China now.
It's us in China.
It's going to be
us
in
Russia
and
China.
It's us, the EU. We are in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
The buzzword of the day is not torture. The buzzword of the day is enhanced interrogation techniques. Can we just agree to call it torture?
Ask what you can do for your country.
Hope you're having a great day in Washington, D.C., or wherever in the world you're tuning the show in today. This is Common Sense, the show that cuts through the spin of the anti-American right-wing nuts and brings it to you straight.
During our show, we'll help you, the listener, try and understand the week's events and what we as a nation can do about it. Our job here is not to change your mind, but provide political perspective and act as your voice to power.
In short, we are here to have a discussion and help you replace the spin with common sense. Good afternoon, everyone, on our inaugural show. Welcome to Common Sense. We're going to apologize ahead of time for some audio difficulties we've been having. This is our first time up on the air. We really appreciate you along for the day. If you are hearing us on our site, it's getcommonsenseradio.com, and our Twitter feed is at Jim Alger. Throughout the course of the day, you're going to be able to send in your questions and comments, as well as call in. We'll have a number here for you shortly. And you'll be able to call in and have your questions and comments brought on air. On today's show, swine flu pandemic. Is it a pandemic? Is it a big problem? Something that we all be worried about, all running for the hills? And is it still the swine flu? Arlen Specter leaves the GOP, or did the GOP leave Arlen Specter? That's another subject we're going to have a discussion about. We're going to talk about whether or not the GOP is dead, or are they just hibernating? Well, last week we had a couple of air scares over Washington. The FAA is going to undoubtedly be cracking down on some individuals who was flying small aircraft over Washington, D.C. And, of course, the FAA themselves allowed a pretty interesting thing to occur up in New York with the Air Force One flyover of New York City. We'll be discussing some live news as things take place, as well as other top stories going on in the day. Here with me today is Chris. Chris, say hi to everyone.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Oh, we get these audio problems fixed, I'd be doing a whole lot better off.
Exactly.
So Obama's got us talked about the swine flu here.
We are continuing to closely monitor the emergency cases of the H1N1 flu virus throughout the United States. As I said this morning, this is obviously a very serious situation, and every American should know that their entire government is taking the utmost precautions and preparations.
Well, there it is. Federal government's taking the utmost precautions and preparations. So it's not the swine flu anymore. It's now the H1N1 virus. My understanding is that the people from the pig farms were having some difficulty with that, and they thought that it was going to affect their the sales of pigs. Apparently, as Mrs. Stewart put it yesterday, they were offended that we would think that it would be a bad idea to eat something that rolls around its own slop all day. So, I don't know. Any thoughts?
It just sounds a little weird, you know, calling into the office. Hi, I can't come to work today. What's wrong with you? I have pig flu.
Well, I don't know. Well, I know TMZ asked, who was it? What's that dimwit? Come on now, help me out here. Paris Hilton.
Oh, God.
Yeah, they asked Paris Hilton if she had swine flu or she was afraid of swine flu. And
No, she's just hybrid pig.
She said she wasn't going to eat it. She wasn't afraid of it because she was, because she didn't eat that.
I will resist the easy joke there.
Yeah, let's try and be good. But you know what's very interesting is that Barack he's actually got a set of samples or things he wants people to do that seems pretty straightforward. And we'll let the president here speak for himself.
Public health officials have recommended that schools with confirmed or suspected cases of this flu strongly consider temporarily closing. And if more schools are forced to close, we've recommended that both parents and businesses think about contingency plans if their children do have to stay home. And finally, I've asked every American to take the same steps you would take to prevent any other flu. Keep your hands washed. Cover your mouth when you cough. Stay home from work if you're sick, and keep your children home from school if they're sick.
Seems to make common sense.
Pretty straightforward, yes.
No pun intended. So is that what we're supposed to be doing? And is this really a big problem? I mean, here's my question, Chris. I don't understand why it is that if we are, people have had the flu before. My understanding is not that many people are sick. So I'm sure I'm not the only one with this question. Maybe you have the answer to it. But why a couple hundred people get sick? Are we all of a sudden freaking out here?
Partially, I think it's the name. The other component to it is that it's a virus that has mutated. The virus originally is one that just affects pigs or swine, and it's very contagious and easily spreadable because pigs are animals that obviously congregate together. They're kept in small, close quarters, and so it goes to them. The problem is that it went zoonotic, meaning that it jumped species from pigs to humans. It also has another component to it. Part of its DNA is the bird flu or avian flu.
Really?
Yes.
I see.
So,
that.
Yeah. And just like when dogs have what's called parvovirus, if anyone who's owned a dog takes them to the vet, you get an inoculation for the dog so that it doesn't get that flu. That's fine. We humans are not at risk for getting parvovirus. However, if it became zoonotic, if it jumped species and all of a sudden humans started coming down with parvovirus, that'd be a huge concern because we don't have a vaccine for that. Like, we can vaccinate our dogs. So that's partially the concern there because it's just a scary thing for people to think, oh my gosh, I'm going to get pig flu. In reality, 30,000 people die from regular flu every single year. Now, in America, we're not dying from it. We do have the first case of, the child who's, 23 months old. He died, but he visited Mexico, and whatever is going on in Mexico as far as, there could be many different issues why they are dying and we aren't. And we don't really have any answers for that.
That is curious how they're dying in Mexico, but not here.
I mean, they're also in very close quarters, a lot of them, Mexico City. Americans really aren't. I don't know how much this plays into it, but we do have a stronger healthcare system as far as if you do get that sick and you go to the hospital, we do have the medications that are easily, we can treat it with the Tamiflu medication and antiviral. So I don't know enough about Mexican health system or the healthcare system there to say how much that plays into it. But, realistically, 30,000 of us dying of regular flu, and we have, 100 or give or take cases of Americans coming down with the swine flu.
Well, yeah, and my understanding is that first it came up from Mexico to be treated in the U.S. and then died in Texas. I don't know if you have a confirmed U.S. Case or confirmed U.S. death from this yet.
No, I don't believe we do yet.
That's interesting. And Hippie Randall on Twitter is commenting to us that one theory is that it dilutes as it travels. That's an interesting one.
Well, all viruses mutate each and every single with every generation. That's why every single year we have a different form or a different version of the flu vaccine. What happens is the CDC, and I don't know if it's the CDC or the WHO, but definitely CDC monitors the influenza virus through flu season, and at the end of each flu season, they look at the strains that they're seeing the most, and then they make the vaccine tailored to that, so that when we swing back around for next flu season, that's the vaccine that people are going to get inoculated with.
Interesting. I'm getting some smart aleck comments here from our guests who are waiting to go on air, but it's not their time yet. But their comment that we should quarantine Congress for their pork spending. That's a good one right there, yeah. My understanding is on this subject here, MSNBC has reported that WHO is taking a gamble and they're switching production to a new shot that actually may keep us with a problem as we go into the next flu season for ourselves. So this is getting interesting. You just have to wonder, you know, this is probably going to be a pandemic by next year. And you do have to just wonder, by next week rather, and you do have to just wonder if this is going to be an issue that we're going to be living with for several years to come as our reaction to this. I don't know. Were we caught flat-footed on this, or do we seem like we're prepared? It doesn't seem like we were all that into...
I don't know how much anyone could have predicted that we were going to get a zoonotic virus, you know, flu, out of nowhere. It's sort of flu season.
It has happened before. I think the last time this strain came out was 1976 or 77. Michelle Bachmann has said that she found it very ironic that the last time this came out was during the Jimmy Carter administration. Of course, it wasn't during the Jimmy Carter administration. It was actually in Gerald Ford's administration. But Michelle Bachmann's always been fast to lose with the facts. Anyway, for those of you who don't know who Michelle Bachmann is, she is a...
joke.
I was going to say moron, but we'll go with joke.
I was being polite.
No need for politeness here. She's the one that wanted to create a house, what amounted to a House Subcommittee on Anti-American Activities to investigate members of Congress. And I got to tell you, when she first proposed this on Hardball, I thought she was out of her flipping mind. And after watching what the Republican Congress has been doing for the past couple months, I'm starting to get on board with this idea. I think that we should start by looking at these Republican congressmen who seem to not have to see a single idea they want to say yes to that the voters didn't vote down. And maybe it might not be a bad idea to start investigating these guys who don't seem to want to get on board and try to help this country and do what needs to be done.
Well, they morphed into the party of no, and now I think they're just taking the logical next step and morphing into the party of go, as evidenced by, I cannot remember exactly who said it, but someone actually wrote regarding Olympia Snow that, you know, after that basically, you know, since she doesn't vote the party line, that don't let the door hit you in the. So they went from their small tent mentality to just everyone go. If you're not going to vote with us 100% of the time, see you, bye. How that helps the Republican Party, the GOP, I have no idea, but, you know.
Well, it does seem that the Republican Party, and I'm going to bring in here actually now, I'm going to bring in one of our guests, Ms. Louise Stone, who is the former president of Southern California Republican Women and Men. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you heard me correct, Republican Women and Men.
Good evening.
And I got close to the microphone there.
Good evening.
Hello, how are you? And so she is also currently on the executive board of aforementioned group, although I have a sneaky feeling that coming on this show might get her credentials taken away. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome to you. And congratulations on your new show.
Well, thank you very much. So you have some comments that you want to make as she's frantically writing notes here and trying. I think she's trying to distract the show is what she's trying to do. But we're just having a conversation, and unfortunately, Louise does not have a headset, so she won't be able to hear you, Chris. So you have some input here on from a Republican perspective. Do you care to share?
It's not necessarily a Republican perspective. I think it's a common sense perspective.
Hey, that's my line.
I don't believe that we were caught flat-footed. I think
with the flu.
The Obama administration is trying to prove that they're on the ball and they're on their toes and they can respond. And I think that you should note that the infrastructure that was left by the Bush administration in this particular matter is what has helped get the medication out. I think that they're overreacting, but hey, the press needs something. Obama's a little boring.
Yeah, Obama's boring. You guys are well, I guess you got over the whole kick about him bowing to the Saudi king there. So, but I don't know. I agree that the infrastructure that's being used now is the remnants from the Bush administration, and I just am very glad the Democratic Congress passed the funding to allow that infrastructure to go into place.
I actually think that we ought to quarantine Congress. They have their own type of swine flu with their pork barrel spending.
Well,
and it is both parties.
I agree that there's a lot of that, but you know what's very interesting about that subject? I'm kind of glad you brought it up, because the whole theme of this show is to kind of cut through spin and get right down to the core of the politics behind what we always hear in these talking points every day. We hear the term pork barrel spending, and then, you know, your pork is my barrel. It's very interesting. If my congressman says, hey, I've got $100 million to repave the freeway in this district, I'm happy as a clam. He's going to save the shocks on my car and make things better for me and put people to work in my neighborhood. And so it's very interesting that I'm not going to say that, you know, things like the Bridge to Nowhere and stuff like that, of course, there's obvious examples. But how much of what you see as pork is actually really pork, and how much is like 10 or 12 examples that just jump out at you, go, oh my God, what could you possibly want with this? But how much of what you really see is identified as pork are just really the congressman filling his constituents' needs and bringing home the bacon, so to speak, which is what everybody wants. They don't have a problem with pork unless it's not coming to them.
I believe that the purpose of the stimulus package was to put people to work. Getting a crew of five together to put in a new swimming pool is not getting people back to work. It's giving jobs to people who, or more work to people who already have the jobs. We are talking about 6.3 million now who are unemployed. And this is newly unemployed.
As a fallout from...
And the pork spending is just out of control. Because it is not effective spending. I think that's a new word. Instead of pork spending, effective spending.
Effective spending. Well, I mean, what's the difference between effective spending and ineffective spending? I mean, from what I can tell, if...
The Bridge to Nowhere is ineffective spending.
Well, one could argue it was going to put people to work, but I agree. It's garbage. Yes, Chris?
No, go ahead.
No, yeah, feel free.
I actually wanted to jump in on... But it's backtracking just a little bit. In all fairness, yes, what the response that we've had to the swine flu is a result of the Bush administration in our ability to effectively respond to it. However, it's part of the response is a result of having dropped the ball so badly with Katrina. I mean, you can't possibly get any worse than good job Brownie as he handled a crisis, a national emergency. So, I mean, yes, we are responding well to the flu, the swine flu, but that's because you can't get negative. You know, we can't do any worse than Katrina.
Well, this is very true. This is very true. By the way, we're going to give out a phone number here. Anybody wants to call into the show, 888-228-4494. anywhere in the world, you can reach that number, 888-228-4494. If you have comments, questions, suggestions on the show, or you just want to vent, or you think the show is great, or you think I'm an idiot, that's fine. Let's hear it. 888-228-4494 is our number. We'll be giving that out throughout the day. I want to get back to this whole Bridge to Nowhere thing and the pork spending that we see in Congress. What is your take on Congress accepting raises? I'll put this to Louise first. What is your take on Congress accepting raises when they're asking the CEOs and everyone else to sacrifice their money, and everyone else in the country has had to sacrifice their money, and then they, of course, drag them beyond in front of the Congress with their trumped-up self-righteous indignation. What's your take on that?
I think it's a major mistake by Congress. They go ahead and they reward themselves when you look at regulation and enforcement that haven't been effective in Congress. Congress is to oversee various departments and how they spend their money and supposed to watch these things. They aren't doing it. And that's why we're in the condition we're in now with look what happened with the SEC, that they were not enforcing regulations that were already on the books. And we end up with people like Bernie Madoff, our whipping boy.
Hold on one. As far as Bridge to Nowhere, are you referring to the bridge that was Alaska or Ted Stevens' pet project?
The question is, are you referring to the Ted Stevens' pet project, but the Bridge to Nowhere? And yeah, that's exactly what she's talking about.
Okay, well, this is 2009, and that was 2005. The Bridge to Nowhere was 2000. And actually before 2005, but Congress removed that, the money for that, a couple years ago. So that has nothing to do with Barack Obama or any kind of pork barrel spending.
Okay. Well, the that was eventually gotten rid of, if I remember correctly.
Correct.
After it really became kind of an outcry. But there's been a lot of complaints, even in the current Congress of spending that's been unnecessary. And, that seems to be the Republican theme. And Louise can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be the theme is that they don't, believe in the spending, for this. And, that they seem to think that the stimulus money should be spent someplace else. Their big thing, of course, seems to be they want everyone to have more tax breaks. And I'm not sure that's really where we want to go.
I'm not talking about tax breaks. I'm talking about common sense government. I'm talking about being fiscally frugal at a time that we keep taking on more and more debt.
Okay.
We need people to work. If people are working, they are paying taxes.
But okay. Then let's stop living in the past. I mean, honestly, you're talking about the Bridge to Nowhere. That's several years ago. That's way before Obama even announced his candidacy for presidency. And so let's talk about what is happening now. Let's talk about what is going on with Republicans and, you know, our budget now and spending.
What is going on with Republicans? They have no power, and unfortunately, when one party has unfettered power in the government, it is a bad time.
That's true, but who is responsible for the Republicans not having any power? It's because of their policies from the past. If they hadn't alienated all the voters and taken away their rights and had citizens going, wait a minute, you know, scratching their heads going, I thought I had, you know, a just say, a right to habeas corpus, then they wouldn't have gone to the polls in November and voted them out of office.
I believe that the Republican Kool-Aid was just not as effective as Obama's Kool-Aid was. Obama's the Messiah. He is looked at as the gifted one who has shown up, and I'm not.
Do you really think I'm going to let you get away with that?
I'm not going to fault
anyone. If anyone could be better,
the people who called him the Messiah is you guys. Which I find it very interesting that GOP chooses to use the term Messiah as a derogatory statement, given how much they love to throw God in our face all the time.
I'm not using it derogatorily.
But the GOP does. No one ever said he was the one, the chosen one. Actually, that was John McCain's little thing. He used to call him the one. No one said that. That was a complete fairy tale when they decided to attack the guy for being popular and people liking him. And that was really interesting to watch.
Maybe that was a little envy that the Republicans were speaking with that.
But envy? Is Republican envy?
With Obama being popular, what's wrong with Obama is his policies.
Okay, what's wrong with his policies? This is what I want to hear about. What specifically is – and more important than what's wrong with him, what ideas, new ideas that haven't been – thrown out by the voters, does the GOP have that could contribute to this dysfunctional family we call the United States of America? Because that's what we are. We are a dysfunctional family. There's nothing wrong with that. But I get so sick and tired of hearing he's wrong, he's wrong, he's wrong. A wild monkey could point at something and say it's wrong. I want to
offer some answers, some suggestions.
I want to hear what could make it right. And because right now, from what I can tell by looking around, the Obama's policy seems to be showing some signs of working. There's a little bit of bumps in the road every now and then, but generally speaking, we're not seeing – I'm going to be corrected by this in a minute if I check the news, right? We're not seeing the stock market collapsing anymore. It's not in a free fall. We see mild corrections every couple of weeks, which is more – normal with the cycle of the gyrating stock market. We're not seeing 900-point drops in a day. We're not seeing the housing market collapsing any further. It does appear the unemployment numbers, while still going down, are now going down at a lower rate.
Only this week.
That's been the past month. The highest one I understand was 740 in February, and we're at 630 in March. I don't know what the April numbers were. That's the trailing indicator anyway. The jobless rate will always follow the economy by 3 to 6 months. So I'm kind of with Jim Cramer on this one, where he said that he believed the economy went into a depression around last August, September. I think that's about right. I think that we got out of the depression right around March. And I think that the numbers seem to bear that out a little bit. From what I can tell. Do you not agree?
I actually think that this started in 2007.
The recession.
Yes. And that we are still in it because the stock market is really more flat than anything right now. We had the best month in April that we've had since, I believe it was 2002, as far as our uptick. But I have a real problem with the promises that have been made, and you can say that I'm just bringing up old subjects and old mantras about the stimulus package and Obama's promises, and yes, he has kept some of his promises. But I would like to know, since the government is so ineffective that the SEC couldn't stop Bernie Madoff, how is the government going to build a green car by becoming the primary stockholder in the automobile industry and bringing in fiat? God help us that we should be riding around in fiats around here. People like their protection. They like their big cars. Let's leave that to a choice. And
it's not the government that's taking that choice away. The free market the GOP seems to love so much is what's tanking Chrysler and GM.
Excuse me, but Mr. Obama promised there would be no bankruptcy if we did the bailouts.
He never said there'd be no bankruptcy. That's incorrect. He never said there'd be no bankruptcy. That's always been on the table. He said that we could avoid it.
The Bernie Madoff fiasco happened.
That's going to be brought in as the bankruptcy judge?
Well, the GOP knows very well how to get Congress to pass specific laws for specific occasions whenever they feel the need to do it. Need I bring up Terry Schiavo all over again?
I don't think that we need to lay that in either in one party or the other. I think that both parties. I'm not saying that the GOP is going to save us. I believe the GOP is going to.
I got to jump in here sometime.
We need balance in our government, and we don't have it.
Go ahead, Chris.
I just wanted to say, I mean, just to keep this straight, Bernie Madoff fiasco, that happened on George Bush's watch. So you can't lay blame at Obama's feet for what happened, you know, while George Bush was in office. And as far as Obama being quote unquote the Messiah, well, you know, yes, that does have a negative connotation to it because of the pictures and the caricatures that we see of them. But that whole thing came about because Obama offered the American people hope. And, you know, just like Jesus did. And, you know, it's kind of unfair to compare them both, but I see where it came from. I mean, Obama had some answers for us to save us from what George Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Alberto Gonzalez had done with the country. They bastardized our country, and Obama offered us a chance to get some of that back, and he is you know, giving us a chance, that, like he said, the audacity to hope, because what happened in the last 8 years is that our government, our country, our rights had become a farce.
What about your Democrat congressman?
Excuse me.
What about what? My Democrat.
We're going to call him Democratic congressman. I'm serious about that. We're not going to allow this Republican GOP nonsense of relabeling the Democratic Party to play Newt Gingrich's childish game on this show. I'm not Chris Matthews. We're not letting that happen. Sorry.
Let's go forward and let's stop talking about the past 8 years and what we're going to do in the next 1,380 days.
Okay.
That's great. Well, let's do it.
That's kind of what we are doing. However, this is going to bring up a very interesting question. I am getting some comments here from the Twitterverse that I feel the need to share. We have lots of fans out here on Twitter. If you are listening to this, our Twitter thing is at Jim Alger. And you can also feel free to call into the show if you're not so shy. That number is 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. We've got a couple of things here I want to hit on. One of them comes from Move and Shake. And I don't know if this is a guy or girl, so I apologize. It says, get your guests to address ideology versus policy. The GOP is scared of Obama being successful. They go on to say sour grapes in the GOP is not helping. That is an interesting point that it kind of goes into what I was saying and what I've been saying for some time, that the Republican Party right now politically cannot afford for Barack Obama to succeed. And by definition, can't afford for the nation to succeed. I mean, do you deny that? I mean, let's look at just a couple of facts. The last time the Democrats had full power of the House and the Senate was in 1977, the first 2 years of the Carter administration. Not a great example, because the country kind of went to hell in the handbasket during that period of time. But we don't want to talk about it. It's our subject for us Democrats. However, that was quite a stretch from 1977 until 2009 for full power. They had partial power of Congress up until 1994. Now, the Democrats had held that for 40 years. until the Republicans took it over. The Republicans took it over, and they held that for over a decade. So we keep hearing Joe Scarborough and other people say, oh, Congress, this can change overnight. Reality here, folks, is it doesn't change overnight. It takes a long time for Congress to switch hands. You'll see the Senate move back and forth. It's about one or two seats. But for the Congress to move, that takes a long time, and I'll explain why in a minute. But I'm curious, this whole ideology versus facts thing that the Republican Party seems to have a problem with, where they allow, you know, stem cell research is a great example. I wrote a stinging rebuke of former President Bush in praising President Obama for his reinvigorating the stem cell research funding. It seemed to be completely ideologically driven. And what is it with the Republican Party? Because, I mean, there is the – do you believe my statement when I say that the GOP of today is not the Republican platform anymore? It just – it doesn't even represent what it says. It seems to have gone so far to the right that – and we're going to deal with Arlen Specter in the next segment – as he said, as some are saying, and I think Arlen Specter said, he didn't leave the GOP. The GOP left him.
He left him, exactly.
So how do you – what do you think about – I kind of give you a litany there, so let you respond to that, Elise.
Well, let's see. You kind of distracted me there with Arlen Specter, and I can say goodbye to bad rubbish on Mr. Specter. But he did write in on
– sour grapes. Sour grapes.
He did write in on
– Kenny River.
President Reagan. And I will agree with you that I believe the Republicans that have been elected have lost their focus. And they have not stayed in the common sense form of government. And they have stayed too long in Washington and lost contact with the American people. They're not listening. They're not saints. They are very bad, and I truly would like to see every incumbent out. And George Bush's policy about stem cell research is not uniform throughout the GOP. You know that there are different factions. So to talk about the 20% extreme right of the GOP is not to talk about the entire party, and don't play that media game.
Okay, so what policies does the GOP want to put forward now that can be productive to the conversation? Because as President Obama said the other day, you know, there's a lot of common ground between Republicans and Democrats. You know, let's face it. It's an old cliche, but there truly is more than unites us and divides us. We get caught up on wedge issues for political strength. Right now they seem hell-bent on making Obama a failure, and it's kind of funny because the harder they say he's a failure, the more he tries to succeed and the better he does. So, you know, what would it take to get the GOP to present ideas? I mean, these are the guys that presented a budget that had no numbers.
Yeah. Why is that? Yeah.
I mean,
magic math.
I see you hanging your head in shame. I don't blame you. I wish that Eric Cantor shared your shame, because then he wouldn't look so like about such a pompous jerk when he's up there spouting off at the mouth, because his idea has been my way or the highway. You either take 100% of what I have to say or you're not being bipartisan. And my position is that these clowns in Washington have no desire to be bipartisan. If anybody wants to know where I split from the president, here it is. And this is where I think we are, folks. If the president truly believes that he can put his hand out to Congress and not get anything else but it bitten off, he has lost his bearings completely.
Well, the GOP, they just continued with their hallmark policy of you're either with us or you're against us.
Well, that's
and
right.
Our guest just completely illustrated the point. She just said, oh, you know, Senator Arlen Specter, go by. Well, that's great. So what? That, you know, you obviously don't care about the people that are in your own party. It's like if they dissent, then, oh my gosh, they're traitors and they're this and they're that and ABC. And it's, And it's the same old thing. It's, you know, whine about one thing, and then, you know, you don't have any answers for it. If we offer any answers to the issues, then, you know, they just continue with their long line of complaints, and their you know, mantra is, look, cut the taxes, cut the taxes. Cut what taxes? Are you kidding me? What, while Americans are jobless and homeless?
Pomposity of power.
Well,
the pomposity of power. No one stuck a gun to any voters' heads and said, vote for the Democratic Party. No one did.
I would argue someone did. I would argue someone did. I would argue that Sarah Palin held that gun. I think that the... No, in all seriousness, I don't want to really rehash the last election. I kind of wish we were on the air then, because that would have been too much fun for words.
Oh, yes.
But when John McCain rolled out Sarah Palin, I believe that one decision in and of itself completely carte blanche made him invalid as far as being a candidate, a legitimate candidate for presidency. There's no way, especially considering the argument leading up was that Barack Obama didn't have any experience. And then they come off with this one who – not only says she can see Russia from her house, which I always thought was just a stupid thing, because she never actually said that statement. She said something similar to that, and Tina Fey panned her. And so instead of clarifying that, she actually dug in on the air. Says, well, you know, they can. When Putin rears his ugly head, whose airspace do you think he goes into? Yeah, and how does Sarah Palin find out about the Russians came into her airspace? She gets a memo from the president's office that says, oh, yeah, this happened yesterday, and NORAD responded to it.
That's because when everything anyone ever challenges anyone on the GOP, all they do is, you know, put their hair on their backs. It goes up, and they start trotting out the rightful indignation baloney. And, you know, and instead of just saying, oh, you're right, I was wrong.
Gets their hair up on their neck when they get slammed like that. The problem is we need to get both parties working together. The animosity has to stop. The animosity will kill this country if we don't all work together. And I'm saying Republicans working with Democrats as well as Democrats working with Republicans.
I think what's ticking off the Republican Party is the Republicans are working with Democrats. That's why you're not in power anymore.
And the Democrats have extended their hand out in, you know, in mutual, you know, let's go forth and let's work together. And what has the Republican Party done? They have not voted, you know, because they don't want to be seen. They don't want to be seen as being a traitor to the GOP. And how that helps any of their constituents is beyond me.
You think that it's just a coincidence that not one single member of the Republican caucus, not one,
you said,
the stimulus funding?
I can't answer for all of them.
I mean, if that's not lockstep,
well,
I don't
answer for
I
one
would
of them.
Certainly say that there's nothing wrong with saying that the stimulus package just Obama abandoned common sense when he allowed Nancy Pelosi to write the stimulus package. For God's sakes, can't the man do anything? He's got to read off of a monitor.
Oh, my God. Wait. Hold on, guys.
No.
Please call in here. We're going to fill this number out here. 8-228-4494. 8-228-4494.
Nancy Pelosi.
And let's ask a question about the Republican Party's utter fascination with the fact that Barack Obama uses a teleprompter, because as if he's the first president. Oh, wait. George Bush did. George Bush had a teleprompter. They actually really spell things phonetically, and he still screwed it up.
Yeah, I was just going to go for that one. At least, you know, when he's using the teleprompter.
It just irks. No, you can't do that. You can't sit there and say, well, your president's using a teleprompter, and then say, well, if I say, well, the previous one did, oh, well, I thought we were moving forward. That's ridiculous. I knew someone who used to say, always leave things in the past. Well, I wish a lot of things get left in the past. It doesn't pass. It's forward. The past.
Jim, speak into the microphone.
The past is what got us here. So we've got to – you guys have got to end this fast. There's actually a Twitter person up here that is TOTUS, Teleprompter of the United States. I mean, they are just fascinated. It just kills the Republican Party that Barack Obama can speak with some level of a complete sentence without tripping on himself or embarrassing this country in his words.
Thank God for the public education system. He can read.
The public education system, the GOP,
okay,
tries so hard to kill every chance they get.
Then what does that say about private education? Yes, at least our president can enunciate.
At Punahou.
Oh, and George Bush did not. George Bush went to Yale, for crying out loud.
Yes.
I'm not sure that he actually went to Yale. I'm thinking it's more like National Guard duty. He just kind of sort of might have showed up. But, you know, a C at Yale is just, that's what you get when your daddy buys a wing there. But we don't have to go in there. In that regard, I will say, let's leave the past in the past. But to move forward, you know, let's talk about a couple things that where this country's really kind of gone sideways. I'm getting a lot of requests here on Twitter to talk about prosecuting Bush and Cheney for war crimes.
Amen.
Be
careful what you ask for.
I want to pose a question, and I'm encouraging, and I'm going to do this constantly until someone relents, because they're loving the whole Twitter thing, and they're afraid of the phone. We have some very shy listeners here.
Maybe they're working.
That could be it. If they're not working, I'm watching them tweet away here. 888-228-4494 is our number worldwide. Here's my question. I'm not talking about people we get from Iraq or on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan. Let me separate those off for a moment. Okay. But on 9/11, were we in a war, even though bin Laden, who is no country, is no nation? It's a serious question. I'm not being facetious here. I'm not playing devil's advocate. I really want to have this discussion. Were we in a war to where the Geneva Conventions would apply to an individual who is a terrorist and is trying to murder innocent people? Then the reason I ask this is because the GOP seems to be doing a really good job of trying to get it both ways. At one point, they want to yell at the Democrats for treating it as a law enforcement issue. The law enforcement issue indicates not at war, hence Geneva Conventions would not apply. But you guys say, no, we're at war. Okay, well, then the Geneva Conventions apply. And you seem to try and split the baby here. And frankly, I think it's kind of a combination of, well, obviously right now we're clearly at war with full military engagement in two going on three countries. We're going to be in Somalia by the end of the year. We're going to be in Pakistan by the end of the year. And anybody who doesn't think so is not paying attention. This is going to get much, much worse before it gets better. We're not going to have a choice but to engage in Somalia with the whole piracy issue, because that's going to start funding it. Those guys hook up with Al-Qaeda, and that's coming. That's the natural evolution of this nonsense.
Yep.
Those guys hook up with Al-Qaeda. If anyone remembers the movie Black Hawk Down, that was the U.S. military's first real interaction with Al-Qaeda after we stopped funding them. There is a lot of talk about Afghanistan, and I want to get into that in a minute. But before I get there, let me go back to this. This entire war crimes thing, when I read those memos of, they call them enhanced interrogation techniques, but let's just, you know, on this show, we're cutting through that crap. It's torture. And if you don't know it's torture, go out and try it. And try it not in a control situation. Try it in a manner where you have someone who wants you dead do this to you. And then tell me it's not torture, and then we'll have a conversation with Sean Hannity. But Sean Hannity agreed to be waterboarded and has still been too much of a wuss to stand up and do it. He said he would do it for the troops, and Keith Olbermann has offered him $1,000 a second. I've offered him $1,000 to do it. He won't do it. I don't have $1,000 a second.
Because he knows what's going to happen. He knows the truth, and he can't stand the fact that he can sit behind his microphone all safe and cozy and warm, while in reality, people actually died from their quote-unquote enhanced interrogation tactic balloon.
Just be careful, because we're standing behind microphones all cozy and warm, too.
Yeah, but I'm not sitting there denying the truth.
Oh, this is true. What do you think about this, Louise, as far as the idea? Because my problem is, it seems to me like the only way we're going to be able to shut Dick Cheney up is to throw him in jail. This guy really does seem to be going out of his way to poke the lion with a stick and really prod himself into a jail cell, because at some point something's got to give. And the way that this happens, folks, if you want to see this occur, is it has to come from you. It has to come from we the people. It has to come from you calling your congressman. I don't care if he's Republican. I don't care if he's conservative. It has to do with picking up the telephone and making three phone calls to two senators, one if you're in Minnesota, and a whole other conversation. And a congressman. That's what it's going to take to do it.
Yep.
It's got to come from the ground up. Barack Obama is being held hostage by the GOP. They have threatened his judicial nominees. He's got a Supreme Court justice fight coming up. And they have threatened to shut down Congress if he tries to go down that road. So this has to come from the people, if for no other reason but to provide political cover for the president. He represents us. If we step forward and say this is what we want, it is what we will get. And I have, we're going to have a guest on here later who's going to be talking about how the people can get what they want by taking their voice to power. And that's going to be coming up in the next hour. It can be done. I've watched it done. I've been part of it. And those of you who don't think that your voice can make a difference have been out to lunch for the past 12 months, because we elected the most unlikely presidential candidate the Democrats have ever come up with.
Yes. George Bush has managed to, you know, his policies have managed to do what was previously unthinkable for our generation, and that is elect a black man, which I think is awesome. You know, I think it does wonders for the country. But it shows so much, what George Bush's policies,
symbolism wise, it couldn't be beat.
You're acting like you think George Bush is a racist.
Do I think
he's
racist? No, I think he's incompetent.
No, I think his policies have been so out of touch with what is the everyday life of Americans. He has pushed his party so far to the right that they tipped over the edge, and yes, some guy comes along and says, I'm offering you hope, instead of I'm going to repress and, all of your rights in the, quote-unquote safety, for your safety, that it's George Bush. It's not about him, it's not about George being a racist. That has nothing to do with it. It speaks nothing about George Bush's racial issue, whatever. That has nothing to do with it.
We have my fill-in co-host here today. Mike O'Connell is here.
Good evening.
And he would like to step in and say a couple of words, too. So have at it. Oh, you don't have at it. I thought you had something to say regarding this whole prosecuting Bush and Cheney issue. I mean, do you think it's a good idea to prosecute him? I guess that's the place to start. What's your take on it?
Oh, well, my take is, in general, when crimes have been committed, you need to follow that through with prosecution. My only concern would be that this was just being used politically.
Well, let me ask you this.
We're in politics.
Would it make a difference? I mean, and the reason I say that is, it's not like we're inventing something. It's not like we're saying, hey, let's go out and see if George Bush was doing, let's say, let's take something that could never actually happen. Having an affair with an intern, for example. Let's go put together a $40 million investigation to impeach the president of the United States of America because he had an affair with an intern. It's not like we're talking about that. We're talking about something that actually affects our country. And the biggest problem that I think is with this torture nonsense is, first of all, at how blatantly the GOP just acts as if it doesn't matter. We have put people in jail for this exact thing. We have put Japanese soldiers in jail for this. We've put U.S. people in jail for this, for doing this exact thing. And to now suddenly act as if, oh, well, if we would go after that, then it's political.
If you do this in a vacuum, it's almost like blaming the entire war on Iraq on the GOP. This was done as a whole by our government.
Well, The
yes.
problem is when you are the one in control, like any company, if you are the one in charge and you are the one that signs the order, you're the one that goes down. And when you've got people like Dick Cheney who can't even stand up now and say, you know what, it's probably a mistake. No, he's saying I stand by it. He's trying to justify it.
We would never even be in this position had we not been lied to from the get-go. When General Powell, Colin Powell, stood up in front of the United Nations knowing full well that that was a bunch of, you know what, then we would not have, the Senate would not have voted to go into Iraq. And this would be a whole entire non-issue.
Well, that may be true.
We've gotten off the topic. We've gone from torture to being led into the war in Iraq, which you're not going to get me to defend. I think that was a pretty horrible waste of resources. But I'm sorry. But if you're talking about the issue of torture, what was allowed, what was not allowed, you may have problems with the way they went about it, but they did go and they got the proper legal authority to do this.
Well, you're talking about for the lower guys, and I'm with you there. I don't, I do not believe for a second that people who actually did the job should be prosecuted. And I know a lot of my friends that sit to the left of me don't agree with that.
You know, as much as I'm no cheerleader for the Bush administration, but I think we're also falling into a little bit of a danger zone here when we just blame everything on him and how horrible that was. When we all kind of went along with it to some degree.
Well, it's not that hard to do when his vice president is saying I'm the one that authorized it. That does make it just a little bit easier to say, hey, it probably should be done. I mean, it was the Bush Justice Department that authorized it. It was the vice president's office that authorized it. And that is an issue. And the CIA, the head of the CIA, the Bush administration authorized it. I mean, and this is why I don't support going after the underlings, because some of them did feel like something was screwy here. And so they decided to go and get an opinion from their superior. And their superior said, hey, let's go get an opinion from the Justice Department.
The DOJ.
And the Office of Legal Counsel. And so when you are a person who works the CIA and they give you in order to say, hey, we need you to do this. And you say, well, give me the legal parameters in which I can do this and still be within the guise of the law. Even though you may be looking to walk up that line and stare at it, you're not looking across it. And so then the DOJ, the people who are lawyers, come back and tell you that,
it's
yes, the Attorney General has signed off on this. The President of the United States has signed off on this. The Defense Department has signed off on this. And the CIA has signed off on this. At what point do you think you're still going to say, well, maybe I shouldn't do it?
Let me jump
you're
in
right.
for a quick question.
You have no right to say that when you're acting under their authority.
Well, if you're in the military, you don't. The CIA,
yeah, that's exactly.
If you have this level of authorization, where is the law that you're breaking? If you did, it sounds from that they ran it through the proper channel, so to speak.
Well, what happened was the Department of Justice manufactured their own law.
Yeah.
They basically authorized their people to violate not just U.S. law, but international law,
mm-hmm.
and commit war crimes. I mean, if we're in a war and you do this, it is a war crime. And to not prosecute war crimes leads to what? It's going to lead to more. At what point do we say the executive office of the United States is above the law? I mean, to me, and this is sad because I despise the guy, but I truly don't want
which to one
both of them. Well, I think that Bush is just an idiot.
Yes, he's a puppet. We're going to take a caller.
We will in a moment. I think that the issue with Dick Cheney is. I don't want to see him in jail. I don't want to see him in handcuffs. And yet I don't see how we as a nation have a choice but to see that happen. San Francisco, line one. Go ahead.
about this very subject. I'm glad to get online. By the way, I suggest you, it would be a great idea to post the phone number on the website because people can't remember what it is. But as to the subject of torture and all this whole issue of whether to prosecute, my position is that laws that are unenforced become unenforceable. And therefore, we have an obligation to investigate and discover whether laws were broken, and if they were, prosecute. Regardless of who it is, let the chips fall where they may.
It's a good point. I think that we have to really push to see for our own credibility as a nation. What really surprised me is who's coming up with this, because the GOP, they're the Law and Order Party. That's their whole thing, crime and punishment.
They used to be.
That's where they discovered they could break them all themselves.
Well, but here's my thing. That if we should not be saying we want to prosecute. What we should be saying is we need to investigate. And it isn't the president's call whether we investigate. It's the attorney general's call. And frankly, I'm not real thrilled with the concept of this, quote, peace commission, end quote. I would rather see an independent investigation, one outside of, you know, even the AG's office.
That's going to come from you.
I mean, from people like you.
I think that's
what we need to do. I think we need to have a full investigation, and if it looks like laws were broken, I believe they were, but I may be wrong.
It sure does seem pretty cut and dry that laws are broken. The question is, were they broken due to a breakdown in translation of legal memos, or were they broken out of direct order? And I'll tell you what is really the most irking thing about this is that this president – got on national television, we're talking about George Bush, got on national television after Abu Ghraib and said this was just a couple of soldiers who went awry. And it turns out it wasn't. It was actually a DOD memo.
These guys
for further interrogation. And they just hung. One of these soldiers, ladies and gentlemen, is still sitting in jail today.
You are.
I mean,
that's another reason why I say we should investigate this action, because when somebody says they should get a pass, I remind them Lindy Englund didn't get a pass, Charles Grainer didn't get a pass, nor did Colonel Kaczynski, who lost her career, and she wasn't even responsible for it. She was the sacrificial lamb
who was
of the Bush
administration. Being vindicated now before the world.
We
owe her and so many of these soldiers a debt of gratitude. I mean, we really do. I mean,
absolutely.
Whether you agree with the war or not, guys, I remember the first Gulf War, and I remember there was a song. I forgot what it was right now, but I could probably find it. There was a song about these guys and that they were in our heart, they were in our thoughts, they were in our prayers. And I look now and I go, where is that song for these troops coming home?
Lee Greenwood's really? Proud to be an American.
Yeah, but that's not. This was a song that was made specifically for the Iraq War. Where is that? Where is Hollywood this time? And, you know, I think that – I'm not saying that they're not supporting the troops. I think that they do. I think that we need to do more to honor the sacrifice. Last year I had the distinct honor of burying my father at – Arlington National Cemetery. And for those of you who come to Washington, I strongly suggest that you take one somber afternoon and prepare to cry, but go and see it.
Well, my uncle is actually still missing in action from the Korean conflict. So his name is somewhere on there. I've actually done an etch of his name.
I think that's
one of the
that we pay for freedom, and that price has been paid in blood, in a lot of blood.
Yes.
And we need to realize the way that we treat our veterans when they come home is a crying shame. It is a crying
shame. We should do that.
We should do that for the show for next week because we are not treating our veterans that are returning from this war, you know, with their head injuries. That is a whole nother topic.
I agree. I think that we have to we definitely have to do something more of that, and we'll take this up at a further show. But you know, thank you very much, caller. I appreciate your call. I want you to get onto what she was saying and expand on this a little bit. This whole concept of trying to of getting your government to respond to you.
Hello.
This whole concept of trying to get the government to respond to you is what is you know, how we can get the government to respond and get the government to do what we want involves picking the phone, making phone calls, and writing letters. I mean, you've taken part in that, haven't you, Chris?
Absolutely. I almost feel like I should, you know, send my senators, secretaries, or law clerks, whoever answers the phone, a thing of donuts every week or a pizza or something in thanks, because I think they actually recognize my voice when I call now. But, what you were just saying just reminded me, you know, the government is for the people, excuse me, by the people. And we really need to keep that in mind. You know, the government doesn't lead us. We're supposed to be telling them our, you know.
It doesn't just have to be the big issues, although I'm going to give you guys a couple of clues on how to get things through as someone who worked for the Senate, on how to get things through. Never be afraid to write your senator, write your congressman. Matter of fact, you should always do. If you're going to write a letter, you should write at least a minimum of three. The three are going to go to your congressman and two senators. Minimum of three letters. Now, that's going to expand. You want to write copies of those letters to any member of a committee that handles that issue that you're dealing with. So, for example, if you're looking to try and get some kind of war crimes thing going on, the Senate Intelligence Committee is currently looking into that. You're going to want to get the members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. You want to write those. Even though they're not your senators, they represent the nation when it comes to these subcommittees. Once you write those letters, you can CC them. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You then also call them. If you are a small business owner or a company or you're a member of a club, don't just send in your personal letter. Send another a separate letter on stationery. Believe it or not, and I know this is bad, but I'm telling you firsthand, the letters that come from businesses get a little bit of a higher ranking sometimes. And there's a whole reason for that, and I don't want to really drum into that right now, but it does.
Money.
Yeah, okay.
Well, not just money. We're talking about the number of people being represented, if you're a group is writing in versus an individual.
You know, because some of the things, you know, even when I was holding my little measly elected office, some of the things that we'd get calls for, and they would say, hey, what I want, which is completely off the wall. I mean, that is the problem. So
we have a caller waiting online too.
Do we? I didn't hear him. Okay. Mine too. Who do you have?
Joe Barrett?
Joe. Joe's supposed to be calling in because he's supposed to be talking about this. Joe.
Yes. Hi. How are you, Jim?
Is a leader of the No to Home Depot campaign, Summer of Hunger. This plugs right into what I was just saying about taking ownership of your community and being able to get government to respond to you. And Joe ran a campaign in Summit to Hunger, California, and now he's gone and moved on to Thousand Oaks, California, and done the same thing there, where he took on a Home Depot development that was being proposed for the local community. And at that point in time, everybody thought that that this was going to just be a done deal and come in. Joe, are you on the air? Joe, are you with me?
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Hey, Joe. How are you?
Can you hear me? I'm good.
So can you tell the people a little bit about the background behind the Home Depot thing and what you did to kind of defeat these guys? Because this was quite an amazing thing.
a little background. Well, this was a community battle that began almost 40 years ago, and it involved a major corporation, Home Depot, trying to come into a small semi-rural community into an area where their store was not appropriate, and in an area surrounded by residential homes on three sides, including a senior citizen mobile homes park, a elementary school that was also a school for special needs kids, and in a town with only one main road. And many in the community got very, very concerned that this Home Depot would not fit our community plan or our specific plan. And we were concerned about the truck traffic. We were concerned that the site was designated as a retail center for that would fill the needs of the local community, and not a industrial supply warehouse like Home Depot. So we took on the battle and started with a little website. Started with a few local meetings among community members, and before you know it, we had thousands of members. In fact, probably over 80 to 90% of the community involved in trying to stop this corporation. And we went through some very serious and stressful times with Home Depot. But fortunately, the happy ending was in January of this year, Home Depot decided to pull out, and the site is now up for lease, and we have the kind of development parties that would serve the needs of the community talking about taking over the site.
And have you gotten any luck? I mean, I heard that the chant of these guys was quite ingenious. They would literally chant, "No Home Depot, we want socks and underwear." And it made me wonder, you know, was Southern Tahoe, California short on socks and underwear?
The problem is that we're a small rural area that's between two mountain ranges. We have one road, and not a lot of land that's available for development. And so what was happening is our local community members, senior citizens, moms of kids, were having to travel to other cities to buy general goods. We didn't have a general merchandise retailer in town. And we felt like that was putting an extreme burden on everyone. And we needed to bring in... we need to bring in something that would serve the needs. And that little slogan, "We need socks and underwear," was a real rallying cry for many people.
Okay, and I think...
Did we lose him?
No, he's here.
Oh, okay.
Oh, he's talking.
I'm here. Yeah.
You're a little bit faded back there. You guys... really, we're going up against a big company that was well-funded. They even sued the city of Los Angeles over this whole thing. Talk to people a little bit about how you organized the community and really managed to swing this around. Because, I mean, I remember this because this is where I served and I worked for the Senate back in California. And this is where I remember this issue very well because – the office was lobbied as part of this whole thing. And I remember thinking and having conversations with other elected officials on the behalf of some of the people there, that where they said, well, you know, you have to come up with an end game, and they're going to do something there, maybe a Home Depot light or something. And you guys actually managed to pull off getting it to nothing at all by applying consistent pressure. Talk to people a little bit about your community organizing. I know it became kind of a bad word in the last campaign. It always strikes me that maybe the reason why Republicans aren't winning elections anymore is because they're not organizing communities. That's a whole other story. talk to people a little bit about how you managed to take this impossible thing and turn it around based on the sheer number of people you were able to produce.
Well, our most powerful tool, and I have to say, is God bless the internet, because we used that as our command central, where we were able to build a website that we updated daily, and that was our goal, to update it daily and keep everyone informed of every little development that was happening. In other words, anything that Home Depot did or the city did or our elected politicians did, we reported on it every single day. And that got people engaged. We created a huge mailing list just by having information booths at community events and walking the streets, really. And we got tons of people involved, and they were very, very concerned about what was happening on that site. But there's one thing I got to say about community organizing and what we did with the Home Depot is not only did we organize the community through the website, through our emails, and through flyering and getting people involved and holding meetings and stuff like that, but we self-educated ourselves about what we were up against. And we learned about city codes, about how the planning department works, about how decisions are made, and how offices in the government work. And in fact, we were very fortunate to have a woman named Abby Diamond, who lives up here in the community, work with us. And she basically self-taught herself the city code of Los Angeles, which a city official told us one time, you know, you guys, I know you don't want to own people there, but you can't just jump up and down and say no, no, no. What you have to do is be able to explain legally why that store should not be there. And that took a lot of self-education. So numbers work. Numbers are essential to any kind of campaign, no matter what the issue is. You have to have a large turnout at any hearing or town hall or any kind of event like that. But at the same time, you've got to know what you're talking about, and you have to educate yourself. You have to learn the rules by which the government plays. The second part to all this is that you don't want to make it an us-against-them kind of issue. If you're dealing with a city, you don't want to alienate the city. You need them to provide you with information and to and guide you on how to move through the process. So while we were engaging the community, building up a big, huge base, cultivating numbers of people to appear at these hearings, we also engaged city officials and asked them questions and tried to learn from them. And at the same time, we were learning the city code ourselves. So it was kind of a three-pronged strategy, which ultimately paid off for us.
Yeah, and I think that Joe's point that he brings up, and this really blends right into the whole torture debate we were just talking about. And I know people right now who are sitting there going, how the heck does Home Depot work in torture? Well, if you ever had to live next to one, you might understand. But seriously, the knowing what you're talking about when you are dealing with a government entity trying to not be irrational, not be far left, far right, but kind of have a legal, concise argument that you can put forward, doesn't make you sound like a moonbat, is always going to help here. Joe, I'm going to put you on hold here for a second. We have Kevin in Raleigh, North Carolina, who wants to discuss the torture with us. And I think it's going to segue back into the whole thing and how we can get people talking about this. Kevin, you're on the air.
Thanks. So my opinion is the most important thing, the first thing we do, is we prevent future occurrences of torture. It's more important to prevent that than prosecution. As much as I want to, you know, hold people accountable for their actions, the most important thing is we establish that it's torture. It's not some kind of fancy interrogation. It's torture. It's wrong, period.
And do you feel that, or would you be concerned that if we said, hey, what these guys did was torture and was wrong, that and we don't prosecute it, that we're somehow setting a precedent down the road to do it again or create some kind of legal mumbo-jumbo to do it again?
Well, I don't say that we necessarily don't prosecute it, but it's a step-by-step thing. You build on things. You make it clear it's torture, it's wrong. That's your first step towards. Then you can look at, okay, how did we get there?
And do you think that's what the president's doing right now?
I hope so. I mean, things are going to take time because it's not 65 to 35, right?
Yes.
In the Senate. And so things are going to take time to get anywhere if at best we are able to hold people accountable. So let's work on something that's probably a little bit more achievable in the shorter term. So if we don't achieve what would be my ideal of hold those accountable, we at least get a prevention.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you very much, Kevin.
Exactly. Thank you.
I could not agree with him more. What he's saying is 100% true. You do have to look forward. And then my only thing is, I don't think I'm disagreeing with Kevin here, that the when you look forward, you do have to look back and be and hold people accountable too. And it's not one or the other, and that seems to be what he was saying. Joe, you still with us?
I'm here. There
you are. Okay. So, you know, like Kevin was saying that, you know, he's talking about looking forward on things. Of course, his issue that he was calling in about was torture. And what I'm talking about is there are people who want to do this. And whether your opinion is for prosecution, against prosecution, or for making sure we don't do this again, as Kevin was calling in about, there really is a playbook on how to lobby your elected officials. Now, what you did, Joe, was you did it on a local level, so it's much more in person, and you bring a bunch of people to the meetings. And, you know, you're dealing with a city council meeting, you get 200 people down there, pretty much whatever it is you want, you should basically get. The issue with Joe, though, was that the level of comparison to the Office of Legal Counsel of the United States and the city attorney of any city is really an amazing parallel because they basically legislate from their office. Go ahead.
I just wanted to jump in real quick and to underline the importance of why, you know, what Joe was saying, or actually not Joe. I'm sorry.
Kevin.
Kevin, our other caller. What he was saying, why it's so important is because, you know, we're not out of Iran. Out of Iraq. And we have right now, we have someone who's being detained in Iran, journalist Roxana Sabiri. And that's important to keep in mind if you're going to, well, not if you're going to, but if you don't support the fact that we are America and that we don't torture, if you don't reiterate that, then it opens up Americans in other countries to, to so much because other countries aren't like ours. They don't have guaranteed rights.
That is 100% true. The Geneva Conventions is what protects our soldiers, and it is an issue. So when people are talking about lobbying Congress to get things done, there are what you're hearing us talk about here, and you can filter them out yourself, is legitimate talking points, so to speak, points that you want to make down the road. And this is what Joe learned, and I keep going back to it. It sounds like you're comparing apples to oranges, but you really aren't. Joe had an issue. The issue was, in his case, he didn't want a Home Depot there. In your case, it's you don't want our troops being tortured by foreign governments.
Or journalists or anyone, right, visitors.
So exactly. Regardless of what the issue is with your government, there is a way that you can be heard. People have political power. They just tend to feel helpless. Joe was not an elected official that I'm aware of. He was not a millionaire. He did not have, that I'm aware of, political contacts. In fact, my understanding, Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, is you pretty much were a guy who just minded your own business before this happened and really didn't know anybody. Or did we lose Joe?
You know, in my case, this was actually the first activist action, I guess, that I'd ever done in my life. And when I had to get up and speak in front of people, I was terrified. I froze up many times at the beginning. But, you know, over time, and as we became more confident and we had learned more about what exactly what we were doing, that confidence began to show among all the members of our group. So, you know, another thing I'll say is that one problem I think a lot of activists have right now is they try to take on too many projects at once. And what that winds up doing is diluting their efforts from one single project. So my advice is to always pick a topic, an issue, and put all your efforts into that one issue until you achieve what you want to achieve, and then move on. Because you can't spread yourself over everything. You can't handle everything. So in our case, we found by focusing only on this one issue, we were able to give it our full-time attention, and we were ultimately able to be successful with it, not only here in our community, but in a couple other communities as well.
That is very great. Thank you, Joe, for calling. I greatly appreciate you being part of the show on our inaugural day. That was awesome. What Joe was just talking about is something that I had done before. I worked against a couple of Walmart stores. I just hate those guys. And the issue is dealing with finding your points on what you want to make that are sound and reasonable, and that make drive the point home. The Walmart people, there's a lot of money that goes out against Walmart because they do hurt this country. They hurt it badly, and most people don't understand it. I'm going to go to a quick commercial here, queuing in the Walmart, and we'll be back here in 30 seconds.
Have you added up all the hidden costs behind Walmart's prices? The estimated $1.8 billion taxpayers shell out for health care because Walmart doesn't cover their employees. The lost wages of 1.6 million women who had to take Walmart to court to get paid the same as men. The countless manufacturing jobs lost while America's largest corporation became America's biggest importer of Chinese goods. Behind Walmart's profits, the middle class pays the price. America can't afford it any longer.
Now that pretty much says it all. That's an ad that was put together by Group Wake Up Walmart. Now, of course, admittedly, they have their position. They want to get more unionization in Walmart, and Walmart fights unions viciously. They're going to be a big part of the Employee Free Choice Act issue coming up before Congress next couple weeks. And we'll be talking about the Employee Free Choice Act in depth next week and what you need to know about it.
Good, thank God, because that whole lie that they're touting with in the GOP is driving me nuts.
Well, as a rule of thumb, the GOP does not like the power being in the hands of workers. That seems pretty consistent. And so once again, I'm sure we'll see a party line vote here. We may even see a couple of Democrats stray.
Well, what bothers me about that is that they just they turn it around and act like if you vote for this, then it's going to take away your rights for that. And you know, what are you doing? What are you saying? Do you even realize what's coming out of your mouth and whatnot? And you're elected officials, for God's sakes.
And yet, across the country, whether it's Walmart, Home Depot, you know, any number of local issues, all the way up to the federal issues, all the way up to electing a president of the United States, it all comes from the people. And that's the common thread that I'm getting at here, is that regardless of what your issue is, no matter how trivial it may be or how major it may be, you actually do have a voice. And if you decide not to use that voice, you've made a choice. You've made a choice to sit that argument out. And do not kid yourself. Do not kid yourself. If you don't step forward and at least try, you have sacrificed and you've given up your right to complain about it.
Absolutely.
That is just one thing I feel. You know, we're going to be, we got about 10 more minutes left in the show here. And I know the airwaves is playing a little bit choppy here. We have one more thing that we're going to be putting on the air. I want to talk about a couple things that occurred over the past week in Washington, Washington D.C. We had a couple of aircraft that
fiasco.
Yeah, fiasco. Not much of one though. As a pilot myself, I can tell you that what happened in Washington was not really that big of a deal. What's gone on in Washington? You're going to hear this occasionally as the years roll on.
A PR fiasco, I should have said.
Well, you're talking about D.C. You're talking about New York. I'm still in Washington. What happened in Washington was on two separate occasions, small aircraft penetrated the restricted airspace in Washington, D.C. And now, to understand this, most pilots who fly small planes do not fly with a GPS unit. They should, but they could run upwards of $3,000 for an aviation GPS unit. So a lot of them don't. And so they depend on what's called VORs, which are radio towers that then triangulate two arrows on the dashboard of the aircraft and tell you where you are in space at any one point in time. And it does involve constantly looking back at a map and going forward. And if you're trying to navigate tricky airspace that has, it's like highways in the air. And, if you ever notice when you see aircraft, most of the time they're all tend to be in the same general area, going one direction or going the other. And that's because they follow airways. They follow specific routes to avoid certain airspace and so forth. But Washington, D.C. after 9/11 became an absolute nightmare to traverse. And it became a real pain in the neck. It's not just a circle around the White House. It's now the entire Washington, D.C. area with certain pathways cut open for small airplanes. Now, the irony about all of this is that the large jets, the ones that were on instrument-rated flight plans being followed by air traffic control, were under all the most restrictive measures you could have, are the ones that caused all the problem on 9/11. It wasn't a small plane. And I want to be very clear about this. When you start seeing this hype about small planes in Washington, D.C., it's just that, guys. It's hype. Is it possible for a small aircraft to do major damage? Yes, it is. I'm not going to say how because I'm not going to give people any ideas, although they probably have them themselves. But I can tell you this. It's not easy. You couldn't do it with traditional explosives.
And you will have an Air Force.
You have an F-16 escort in the
exactly.
It's 9 times out of 10. Well, I'll actually go further than that. I think 99 times out of 100. It's some joker who didn't follow his VORs properly, got strayed slightly off course, or the wind was blowing the aircraft a different direction, and he's up to with his kid and go, oh, my God, is that the White House lawn?
Whoops.
And until the F-16s are firing flares across his bow, he didn't even know where he was. That is more common. And this is what happens when you have what my good friend here, Mike, loves to call security theater. It's the appearance of security when it's not actual security. And you can't do a lot. If you took a Cessna 172 and I rammed that thing into a building, and I know people have done this, not on purpose, but I've seen them do it. And you've seen on the news where they fly, they flew into a
house.
Beach building. One flew into a house, one flew into a B of A building down in Tampa. And if it wasn't for that building having a window where he penetrated the building through the window, that aircraft would have gone splat on the side of the building and fallen 30 feet to the ground and not have been in on the sidewalk.
Wasn't he sticking halfway out the building?
He was sticking halfway out the building.
It was comical.
It was, if I remember correctly, that guy committed suicide was his deal.
That,
We call that organ donors.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, it's tragic. I get it. It's tragic. But we'll take one of these goofy events. And then what happens to general aviation? They just start torquing the screws down. As a pilot myself, I'm offended by this. People think of people who fly aircraft as being rich and do whatever they want. Baloney. I mean, we got an aircraft. What do we pay for that thing? We pay about $100 a month for the plane. We won't own it for the next 30 years.
You're talking just to tie it down.
Well, so it's $200 if you include that. It's not tremendous. It's not a millionaire's thing. And small aircraft, I'm part of Angel Flight, as I believe Mike is as
awesome.
Well. Angel Flight, we donate the aircraft and our own piloting time to fly sick children into medical care that could not ordinarily get it. During Hurricane Katrina, many of you know, I used my aircraft to go down there and ran a civilian air rescue operation with not just myself, but dozens of other pilots. The small aircraft can get into airfields that big airplanes cannot. You can land on roads if you have to. So this idea that we should start turning the screws on small aircraft is ridiculous.
I think the laws themselves are ridiculous. And I think what we all want is we want the law to be based on a real threat, on something rational. And when you have laws such as the airspace restriction over Disneyland, if you were a couple thousand feet over Disneyland already and you, God forbid, decided to do something, nobody's going to stop you. So you really have to question why that's really there.
Well, what's really ironic about this is that they talk about the airspace and the restrictions, it causes terror. I'm going to play something here of what causes terror.
Run, run.
Oh, my God.
I'm in Jersey City, New Jersey, and we want to know what's going on because there's like planes. Look, they're going inside the buildings. Everybody's outside going crazy.
There's what?
It looks like planes are going. They're trying to go in the building. Everybody's outside going crazy.
What's trying to go in the building?
It seems like a plane was trying to go into one of the buildings.
A plane?
Yeah, but they don't know if it's federal practices they do in the air, but we're all outside by the Hudson, and we don't know what's going on here. There's no cops. Nobody's telling us anything.
That was the terror that was caused over Midtown Manhattan when the presidential air wing geniuses decided they were going to send Air Force One, well, it's not Air Force One, the president's not on it, but it would amount to an Air Force One aircraft, with a fighter jet in tow over Midtown Manhattan with FAA approval. The same FAA who was in the process of ripping these two pilots for doing their little stuff down in Washington, D.C., approved this nonsense and kept it quiet from the people. I don't know if they didn't think anybody was going to notice. Now, the show's almost over here.
Not a whole lot of common sense in that.
Not a lot of common sense in that at all. I wish we had more time to talk about this because the level of stupidity to do this over a city where the entire city is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and you can't blame these guys. And when you hear that tape, it is riveting. It brings you right back to the day that all happened. And to turn what could have been a PR thing into, hey, bring your kids, make a sandwich, bring a blanket, come sit down at Battery Park and watch Air Force One It seems like that got turned into a big fiasco that didn't need to happen. And, you know, now they've got internal investigations and everything else. And it just strikes me as very strange that no one thought of this. But the point that I'm getting at is that the FAA knew about this. We should encourage obviously an investigation into this. I'm not trying to put someone's head on a block, but understand that mistakes happen, and the FAA makes mistakes all the time. These pilots make mistakes all the time. We are human. We all make mistakes. Our politicians make mistakes. Now, we have to be very careful about is that we do not allow small mistakes to become a big deal, get spun out of whack by someone who's got a political agenda or anything else. Remember when you hear something and you hear and you think that someone is, oh, my God, how could they possibly do this? Well, the reality is they probably didn't do that. And that probably isn't true. Rem, you want to take a couple of Twitter things real quick?
That's what I was thinking is we have a few more minutes.
Oh, we can do that. I will answer this question. The $40,000 an hour thing, this once again, this comes down to spin.
You're talking about like the equivalent of $700 hamburger.
hammers.
Yeah, exactly. It's spin. They're trying to make the GOP is trying to say, oh, my God, Barack Obama. Well, first of all, Barack Obama didn't know anything about this. Second of all, the pilots that went up had to go up anyway as mandatory recurrency training. They have to fly a certain amount of hours. So someone actually did think enough to say, hey, he's got to go in this bird anyway. He's got to be up for, you know, 5 or 6 hours. Let's go ahead and send it to New York and take the pictures while we're up there. I've got no problem with that. There is a legitimate reason to say we want to take nice pictures of Air Force One as a symbol of America, a symbol of our freedom, and encourage people to travel to the United States and get that done. There's legitimate PR purpose for that. And to try and put that into the auspices of a training mission does seem appropriate. But to not tell people as if they're not going to notice, just beyond. And then I love this guy. I wish I knew his names. I'd like to just drag him across the railroad tracks from the FAA, who actually said that they wanted to have Air Force One fly through the canyons of New York City.
We have no canyons in New York City.
New York City? If you are in the quote-unquote canyons of New York City, you're not legal.
You're not in New York City.
So it does strike me as really ridiculous. The FAA has no excuse. They should be issuing the apology immediately. They could have turned this into a nice, wonderful PR thing, done on a Saturday afternoon and have a little mini air show out on Battery Park and in Jersey City, and instead they just totally, completely screwed the pooch. And Snuggles on Twitter is asking, how could they do that? I don't know.
I really can't imagine not thinking of 9/11 in that circumstance.
Well, they thought about 9/11. My understanding
is somebody come to me and propose this idea, that's got to be the first thing that come to mind.
My understanding is my understanding is that what they were afraid of was somebody was going to attack the aircraft because it was flying low over the harbor in predictable patterns.
They didn't think about the citizens.
They're flying it. First of all,
it was very insensitive.
I've got to think, you know, once again, common sense. I've got to think that we've got better targets than a moving Air Force One at 2,200 feet, which is not going to be simple to get to.
Sends people scurrying?
That sends people scurrying. You know, why wouldn't they just? You know, I'm not going to start pointing out targets. I don't want to encourage people.
It's not like we haven't had scares either. There have been commercial flights that were cleared to fly low over New York, and it caused scares. It caused people to call in.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know anything about that as far as New York City, but
it's happened. It's happened quite a bit. Where it was shortly after 9/11, where they
Southwest,
Continental.
Oh, anyway, Continental.
They were flying the troops, and they flew the troops past Ground Zero.
In any event, we had a low flying, you know, commercial style Boeing aircraft, and it caused a lot of panic, a lot of calls into law.
Well, I think the difference was when you're circling the buildings and circling the area as if you're looking for something. That really, you know, sends people into a panic.
Well, yeah, I think, and seeing the fighter jet in tow probably wasn't that great. I saw the video now. That audio feed doesn't do a lot of justice. The video was even more
that video's bad.
Striking. It was horrible because you see the people run. And they run out of Battery Park, and they're terrified. And I'll tell you,
and they're calling 911.
And you know, Chris, because you were there, as was I.
Yes.
It was when I saw the video, it did. It brought it right back to me. It really did. I didn't think so at first when I saw the far away video.
Well, I think we had a couple of videos there. We had a video where it was almost like it was taken by another aircraft, and it's pretty obvious that it's Air Force One, or, you know, as you say, the president's aircraft.
We have 1 minute to kind of, you know, thank our viewers.
Viewers? I think you mean listeners, yes. But yes. I just for the record, I tried
to do
this.
I see you, so I'm viewing you.
Oh, that's true, viewers. I tried to do this 4 minutes ago, but we'll do this again. I'm going to say thank you for everyone who came in and allowed us the a pleasure of being in your living room and bumbling through our 2 hours here. My apologies, like every new show. I think most of it went pretty well, but we had some small technical issues. We'll try to get those resolved over the course of the next couple of days. We know what went well, what went right. We'll still be on Twitter, at Jim Alger. I'll still be here for a little while, so feel free to send your comments on the show if you have recommended improvements, by all means. Our email address.
Thank you to the callers.
Thank you to the callers. Our email address is mail@getcommonsenseradio.com. You can see us on the web at www.commonsenseradio.com and also see our blog. Thank you very much, everyone. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
And you have a great afternoon.
Absolutely. Good night.